Before we start, let me contextualize a bit. The reason I wanted to, I made that failed attempt to get some Charlie Parker noise, is those of you who are familiar with the music, I won't bother playing it. For those of you who saw the clip a little bit, here in 10 o'clock in the beginning of a dreary autumn day in 2009, how does that strike you, just visually? What do you think of it when you see some dude in a cool suit playing jazz in late 50s? What's your first reaction? Is it fresh? Is it slightly dated? Is it period? Is it classic? What do you normally think? I was hoping to wake you up with it, but yeah, this will have to do. Go on. What do you think? Yeah?
Well, one thing which looks like another world is the way the one who's waiting for his turn to come in, he's sitting there with a saxophone and a cigarette.
Yeah, yeah. Looks like another world is a good place to start, John. In other words, those of you who've read the book, Colin McInnes's novel, will have noticed the jazz references there, and will have noticed the particular way in which jazz is presented there. Namely, with an accent on freshness, on newness, and the idea of beginning that leaches into the title, right? Absolute beginners. And if you notice how McInnes presents jazz incessantly as a theme through his narrator, this idea of freshness and beginning quite often gets conflated with the idea of jazz being the beginning of something new. Now, to our eyes, as John just pointed out, today, the idea of it being new seems slightly odd, right? Another world is how John put it just now. In other words, the idea of newness being temporary, the idea of newness being transient, is one of the things we get from McInnes' meditations in the novel. I want you to hold that thought in mind. I don't want you to sort of necessarily make a banal point about everything that's new becomes old, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. That's not really what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is I'm suggesting McInnes in the novel meditates on this idea of freshness, newness, and one other term that usually goes with it, modern or modernity. Think of the times, the number of times you've heard fresh beginning, new beginnings, a modern beginning. In other words, the idea of newness quite often gets conflated with ideas of modernity, contemporaneous, etc., etc. Now, one of the things that happens in the novel for McInnes is he's inviting us to think of how this happens. That is to say, quite often the notion of beginning, the notion of freshness, seems to arrive at us fully fledged and fully formed, but one of the things McInnes asks us to do, or will do in the novel through his narrator, is to meditate on this idea of freshness as something that is produced, right? Something that doesn't arrive fully formed, but it is of a moment, and that moment passes. It is of a moment in history, it's of a moment in a community, it's of a moment in a city, in this case London, of a country, so on and so forth. So one of the things he's asking us to think about in the novel is this idea of beginning, typically associated with things like youth, things like a particular subculture, whether that's musical or not, that has a shelf life, and that is, to some extent, and somewhat disturbingly, produced. That is one sense in which beginning is threaded through the idea of the novel. Counter to that is also a more positive, more liberatory thing, idea of beginnings. That is to say, a beginning as genuinely full of possibilities. And one of the things I'm suggesting that he does in the novel, as we go through the themes, we'll see this, is really situate us squarely in the middle of this contradictory pull in the idea of beginning. One, the slightly disturbing idea of beginning being manufactured beginnings. The second idea of beginnings being actually truly full of possibilities, right? And that is, as I said, is echoed in the title, Absolute Beginners. Now, in your handout, if you look at that third point there, one of the ways in which beginning is presented us, or the idea of beginnings, fresh starts, etc., is presented to us in the novel, is obviously through the idea of youth, through the presentation of youth, young narrators. But somewhat already, in the beginning of the novel, we already find the narrators slightly world-weary and cynical. This is what, obviously, famously, the novel starts as. This is your first quotation under point three, under that title I've said, Consuming Youth. It was with the advent of the Laurie London era that I realized the whole teenage epic was tottering to doom. 14 years old, that absolute beginner, they buy us younger every year. I want you to notice that conflation of the idea of absolute beginning and buying, right? They buy us younger every year, I cried. Why? Little Mr. L's voice hasn't even dropped yet, so who will those taxpayers, that is to say adults, try to kidnap next? So already in the beginning of the novel, you have this idea of absolute beginnings or beginners associated with youth, but a youth that seems to be at this stage manufactured, right? They buy us younger every year. There's this disturbing conflation between the ideas of beginning, of youth, of freshness, and the idea of commerce, where all those qualities are up for sale. Another point in the novel, one of the characters called the teenagers mindless butterflies. They're turning, this is your second quote in the Consuming Youth section, these teenagers are ceasing to be rational, thinking human beings and turning into mindless butterflies. As you can see, very cool teenagers hanging out there in the 50s. And they're turning into butterflies, and that is and the next words are important here, of all the same size and color. Okay? So butterflies, but here, butterflies are not of full of the usual connotations of being beautiful, free, everything else, but they're homogenized. They're all of the same color. So right from the beginning in the novel, we are plunged into this idea of beginning, beginners, youth, teenagers, but somehow there's this uneasy relationship between this idea of beginning and the idea of it being utterly and banally commercialized. Okay? They buy us young every year, and moreover, they turn us into butterflies of the same size and color. So there is no variety there. There are no possibilities there. They are full of the same mundane uniformity that is produced, nevertheless, as spectacular. Right? All those usual words associated with any youth subculture. It's exciting, daring, cool, etc., etc. One of the strands of McInnes' novel is to show us, or invite us to think of how this is produced artificially and how actually homogeneous this is. It's not about variety. It's about producing lots and lots of people with same tastes, same kind of preferences, same kind of appearances, etc., etc. And one of the ways in which this novel is prescient of what is of our times, really, is captured in the third quote there in your handout. And this is one of the characters who works in television, the newly burgeoning. Think of how television is produced in the novel in the 50s. It's pretty much like how internet appeared to us in the mid-90s, this new exciting medium that produces possibilities, that produces youth, that throws back a picture of possibilities to us by which we should be living, apparently. This is one of the television executives talking about, again, about beginnings and youth. He says, today, each woman, man, and child in the United Kingdom can be made into a personality, a star. Whoever you are, and I repeat, whoever, we can put you in front of the camera and make you live for millions. Again, you have this idea of a fresh possibility. He's saying TV is a new medium. Whoever you are, we can put you. And he says, whoever, all of you are interchangeable. It doesn't matter really how specifically individual you are, how different you are. We can put you in front of television and make you a star. So the genesis or the beginnings of what we now see in programs like Big Brother, etc., etc. In other words, reality TV. Whoever you are, you will be a star. The idea of whoever you are, with your connotations of freshness, youth, etc., can be produced as an artificial star. That is really the import of what one of the strands in McInnes is thinking. So, mindless butterflies, all of the same color. Mindless butterflies now unprecedentedly in public view through a new medium of television. And mindless butterflies up for sale, right? They buy us younger every year. That is one strand in McInnes' thinking about beginnings. Absolute beginners seem to contain within itself the idea of absolute beginning in the novel, seem to contain within itself this disturbing idea of production of this gleam of beginnings. Okay? In other words, an artificial production of this whole idea of freshness and beginnings. Now, having started on the cheerful note, why do you think, is that an idea that sits comfortably with you? For example, you know, this idea of freshness, youth being produced, being turned into stars for consumption. Is that idea perfectly acceptable, or is it slightly disturbing? Yeah? Guilty.
Which, you know, they come in different colors and slightly different sizes, but ultimately, many of us are following fashions and things mm-hmm. which are set season by season mm-hmm. by companies which are making money out of us as a market. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely true.
You're absolutely right. Why is that idea of being subject to market? Thank you for wardrobe advice, by the way. So, why is that disturbing to us? Us being subject to these forces that make us. Yeah.
Because at the same time, we're always told that we're all individuals and we have an expression.
So, and that is exactly at the heart of the matter, isn't it? On the one hand, I walk into whatever high C store and get a red hooded sweatshirt because I think, oh, that's so me, right? That's individual, right? Of course. At the very moment I hand over my debit card, I have signed up to being, you know, as being one of the dupes of the society around us, because I've generally signed up to being utterly conformist, right? I've just signed up to this idea of being individual when I'm really buying exactly what a billion people around me have bought. Okay? So what is disturbing there is at the same time we're being told that the idea of the individual is the most precious, one of the most exciting things that can happen to us. I am me, I'm distinctive, etc., etc. The very route through which that individualism arrives at us makes us victims of conformism. Right? That is what's really disturbing. I think I am me, but actually I'm one of the parts of the millions of drones shuffling, sleepwalking through the markets. Right? That is what is disturbing about that idea. And it starts really in this conjunction in the mid-50s with this influx of new money. Remember, the narrator is all constantly talking about how cool it is to be young now because of all the new money that's available. But one direction that availability of cash and money and luxury takes is towards this new conformism. However, that is not the only direction, and that is what's really important about McInnes' book. If he was merely saying that the idea of beginners is really, we talk about being individuals and being fresh beginners, actually we are all robots being dictated to by some guy sitting on the top of Tesco's, right? If that was the only thing that his book was offering us, that would be perhaps a less important message, because in a way, that's not particularly new at this stage to us. What is new, or what is exciting, well, one of the things that's exciting about McInnes' book is this idea of beginning retaining its radical possibilities. Okay? The idea that despite this conformism that offers us fake beginnings or offers us ideas of fake individualism, actually, that is not the whole story. At least part of the story is a liberatory possibilities of beginnings, that the idea of beginnings and actions of youth, freshness, etc., holds within itself this contradictory pool. One side of it is this notion of artificial production. The other side of it, however, is this moment, is this possibility of genuine collective liberatory actions, right? Notice how, for instance, London is produced in the novel. Remember, this is a city rising from the war 39 to 45. In many ways, London is at the cusp of a beginning in the same way the teenagers are in the novel. So one of the things that McInnes does in the novel is run the idea of the individual very, very closely with the spaces that these individuals inhabit, in this case, London, right? This is a city rising from the ashes of war, from immense political upheaval, and is now at the cusp of a new beginning. Now, okay, a lot of these new beginnings are already absorbed by these television executives and the big businessmen and the car industry executive we see in the novel. But there are other sides of the city and other groups of people who absorb within them a genuinely radical possibility of beginning. McInnes is a big fan of London in his real life, obviously. One of his quotes on London you'll find in your handout under point two about post-war London, the first quote there. Look at this again, how he juggles that thought of new and not so new beginnings in his description of London. Considered purely as a creation of man, he says, London is largely a shameful shambles. But considered as a place in which men may freely dream, it is one of the happiest cities in the world. So for McInnes, the idea of London holds these contradictory ideas of possibilities and beginnings together. On the one hand, it is really shambolic, considered, as he says, as a creation of man. All the rhetoric about rebuilding the new city as a new Jerusalem, etc. London in 50s appears to be just a sham, just a fake. On the other hand, it is precisely in the unregulated bits of London, the bits of London like Napoli that he finds himself in. Note closely his description of Napoli, about how physically run down it is, at the same time, how spiritually uplifting it is. He says, I've never felt freer than when I was walking these or living in this really run-down bit of London. So the bits of London after the war that have been, quote, regenerated, appear to him, in other words, the glossy London of new buildings, of new media, of new tenants, of new money coming in. Those bits appear to him to be fairly shambolic and not really exciting. That is not where the absolute beginning is taking place. Where it is taking place, however, are in this apparently rundown, unregulated spaces. Remember how really dodgy, and I'm sure you can come up with matching stories about dodgy landlords, but remember his landlord, how he describes his own flat and his landlord, how really it seems to us just slightly beyond the pale of respectability and law. That is where he locates this notion of happiness and dream and freedom. However, this is what he says about his flat and area. However horrible the area is, you are free in there. I repeat, no one has ever asked me what I am or what I do. So notions of beginning, notions of absolute beginning, on the one hand, has negative connotations here of production of the market, etc., but also they're what we might call spaces of hope built within this notion of beginning. In this case, we're talking about London and how the various parts, the really rundown parts of London, appear to be, to the characters and really to McInnes as well, to contain the germ of happiness and dream. I'll go back a little bit about and talk about McInnes and how he, as a literary and cultural writer, that notion of beginning that he runs through in his novel was important to him biographically as well before we move back to the novel. Note how he talks about Rudyard Kipling. Now, any ideas about Kipling? who he was when he wrote what he wrote. Have you encountered Kipling before in any form or shape? Sorry? Children's stories, such as Jungle Book, most famously, of course. Yeah? Just So Stories, etc., etc. When was he writing then? Any ideas? First World War. Yes, he was definitely writing then. Sorry? Turn of the last century. So in other words, just, and you know, he lived through the First World War, died in 1930s, did most of his work in sort of the 1880s to 1914 period. So in other words, earlier than Colin McInnes himself, note how he describes his literary here. So he's a writer who's beginning to make his mark in the 50s London. He's in some ways an absolute beginner, just as his narrator and characters are. If one is entitled to be proud of a distant relative at all, I most certainly and most respectfully am of him. Mm-hmm. And that strangeness is precisely what I'm getting at. The idea of an absolute beginner writing in a definitively post-Kipling era, still tracing his own roots or the notions of his beginnings onto a writer, as you just said, is an icon of colonial British era and colonial British London in some ways. So in his personal life, just as he does in his fiction, the notion of beginning and roots for McInnes is a complicated one. He's unlike a lot of, let's say, artists who position themselves as avant-garde. He's really aware that his own beginning as artist owes something in complicated ways, not simply his relationship with Kipling, just as his relationship with his own father, which is your second quote in that handout. It was complicated. Note how he describes his own father. I also had, somewhat surprisingly, he says, it would seem, qualifies it again, a father. His personal life left much to be desired, but as an artist, and this notion of an artist beginning is really important to Colin McInnes, but as an artist, he, my father, was a very great one. He was born in Lancashire of Scottish immigrant parents who were very poor, politically active radicals. Just like Kipling, he has a complicated relationship with the notion of his father as not a very nice man. As you say, it's surprising, I actually have a father. But as an artist, he was a very great one. In other words, the third notion that McInnes brings to play in the book itself is the notion of artistic beginnings and how complicated they are. Very, very seldom, as his treatment of his narrator will tell you, does art, or despite all his protestations, really make a clean break with its own past. Very seldom it is an absolute beginning point of beginning in the way it likes to dress itself up to be. Quite often, more often than not, this is what, in his biographical reflections, he really invites us to think about art, that all art, however radical this particular form of the novel that he experiments with is, actually has roots that go back, in complicated ways, not simple ways, to artists like Kipling and his own father, whom he talked about actually quite incessantly in his own life. Coming back to the novel then, the notion of beginning having actually quite complicated roots, the notion of beginning being at the same time constricting and liberatory. These two ideas are presented to us straight off in the novel. But running a bit with this idea of beginning as liberation, jazz we've already talked about, and you can see his quotes about jazz in your point 7 towards the end of the handout here. Actually, that's not... Hang on, sorry, it's in point. It's in the first page of your handout. That's the continuation of that quote there. Because jazz is a thing so wonderful that if anybody doesn't rave about it all you can feel for them is pity. But the great thing about Jazz World and all the kids who enter into it, and this is the crucial point here, is that no one, not a soul, cares what your class is or what your race is. One of the beginnings, or one of the positive beginnings we find in the novel, are associated with two themes, one of music, one of sex, right? These are the two wide cultural activities where McInnes's narrator initially locates hope. There's a third factor, and I'll come back to you, and a third crucial factor, I'll come back to that in a bit. But initially, all that jazz in the novel is really about what he says in that final line, nobody, not a soul, cares what your class is, cares who you're from. Nobody pigeonholes you, nobody typifies you, nobody makes prejudgments on you or what your race is. That's what great for McInnes, or McInnes's narrator, that's what is great about jazz. There's something else, obviously, that you will have noticed in the novel, the location of liberatory possibilities in sex. Alongside music, alongside teenage music, the sexual life of individuals are occasions in which people seem to be able to break out of that deadening hand of production of newness that a fully commercialized society offers you. And in particular, note the treatment or the characterization of women here, both young and old. If sex is one zone where you can be who you are, just like you can be in jazz, one of the main agents of that zone of liberation are the women in the novel. Now, the narrator has a complicated relationship with women in the novel. He's not always appreciative of the fact. For example, his own relationship with his mother starts off on a very hostile note, right? He's constantly talking about how hard his mother treats his own father, how alienated he feels from her, etc., etc. Note also how he starts talking about his on and off girlfriend, Crepe Suze or Suzette. Again, there's a sense of, I'm immensely attracted to this woman, but I'm not quite in control of this woman. Note the first description of Suzette. The fact is that little sweet 17 Suzette is spade crazy. I've often explained to her that to show you're a friend of the colored races, you don't have to take every spade you meet home and drag in between the sheets. But of course, Suzette doesn't pay any attention to his words. And he's quite fond of Suzette at this point, but also slightly annoyed by her habit. Right? Okay, you know, you're doing great for race relations. You don't have to have sex with everyone. That's what he's saying at that moment. He's slightly peeved by the fact that Suzette is not slightly out of his own control, and is her own agent. She's young, as young as he is, 17 Suzette, but she already has a very well-defined idea of sexual autonomy. And the narrator is slightly uneasy with it. That raises Suzette's attraction to his eyes, but also makes him anxious and really feel a bit disempowered vis-a-vis her. Note also how he describes his own mother. In the beginning of the novel. As for the numerous additions, his mother, you remember, runs a kind of lodging house. She's the landlady. As for the numerous additions, these are mum's lodgers. And some of them, as you'd expect if you knew Ma, are lodged in very firmly. Though there's nothing my dad could do about it, apparently, as his spirits were squashed by a combination of my mum and the 1930s. Right? Again, there's this tone. There's this half-humorous, half-caustic, but as you'll find out later as the narration goes on, that he realizes after several encounters with his mother. So his mother here is presented as, just like Suzette, very strong woman with her own sexual autonomous preferences, nothing that his own dad could do about it. At this point, that's a source of profound bitterness and anxiety to the narrator, which he hides behind his slight bravado about talking about his mum. Later in the novel, there's this one significant encounter where he accuses, he makes many accusations against his mother, but he confronts his mother on these same grounds, that you have no moral rights to talk about my life because look what you do. And his mother makes a very, very clear and irrefutable answer. She says, as for love, you don't make conscious choices about who to love and who to throw away. You love someone because. And I'm not accountable to you in terms of who I love and who I don't. If I don't love your dad, it's not that doesn't make me a vicious person. At that point, I love you, on the other hand, and look how you treat me. Everything that, the way that you behave towards me hasn't changed my love to you. So there's no kind of prejudge grid for me. I make and choose my own destinies of, in relationships without a kind of prejudged normative category. Okay? Just because he's your dad doesn't mean I have to love him. And the narrator at that point is flummoxed. He can't come back to it. He quickly shifts to the story of his own life. In other words, the relationship between sex and liberation presents itself to, as an enticing possibility to the narrator, but at the same time, he has to learn that sex as liberation doesn't always happen on his own terms. That is to say, the other agents in that particular act, the two women he seems to be most intimate with, Suzette and his mother, are their own autonomous agents that to some extent fashion their individuality. So liberation, yes, but it comes with a twist, right? And he has to reconcile himself to this twist. That liberation doesn't mean for him a free-for-all. It doesn't mean that other people will necessarily be at his beck and call. What he has to learn to do is to negotiate with other people as individuals and then see if they can find a common ground. Now, what happens in his individual relationship is exactly what happens at the communal level in the novel. The London that he finds himself in, obviously memorably in the last half of the novel, is literally a war zone. Race riots have broken out in 1958, and that's the last half of the narrative. But also, London is the center of what seems to be a global conflict going on. Remember that exchange between his brother, or his half-brother, and himself. He says, where were you in the war? Why won't you do your national service? He says, which war are you talking about? Is it Suez? Is this Korea? Is this any of the million wars going on in the world in which we're implicated in? Is this the nuclear holocaust that's going to overtake us? So London, although it's been presented as the center of possibilities, is also at the center of a murderous conflict that's going on globally. At the same time, a fraction of this murderous conflict arrives in London in the form of race riots, which is the last part of the novel, which is taken from the 1958 race riots, which happens not just in London, outside London as well, but most memorably in London, a photograph from there, which McInnes was profoundly shaken by, just like his narrator. So remember the earlier description of London as this space of hope where you can be free? Just like in terms of private, the realm of the private, that is to say the realm of sex, the narrator has to learn that those connotations of individual freedom comes at a price, and that price is usually paid by other people. And he has to come to terms with that fact. His idea of a free London, where he can be what he wants to be, comes at a price of that. That there are other individuals in London, mostly in this case West Indian immigrants, for whom London is a very different beast. It's an arena for struggle or for survival. And one of the things that happens to to the narrator is towards the end of the novel, he learns to let go of an individualism, of an idea of individualism that's based on immediate consumption and satisfaction, private satisfaction and consumption, and move towards an idea of community with of a communal shared space with a host of different kinds and different groups of people. West Indian immigrants, Soho Bohemians, his own teenage friends, his friends from the streets. They form a band against what he sees to be this murderous zone of conflict and murderous and really constricting conflicts going on in London. So remember that earlier description of London as a zone of liberation? It's also a war zone, and it is through an immersion into those conflicts, through an immersion within those conflicts, that the narrator's education, because in some ways that is what is happening in the novel, he starts as a fully formed, very self-conscious individual. I am X, I know exactly what I want, you know, these people try and buy us off, but I won't be bought off, etc., etc. And then he realizes what he imagines to be the zones of freedom, his own rundown neighborhood, his various sexual dalliances, the city of London itself, the forces that he imagined that made himself free are entangled with other people. He has to somehow find a common ground where he can negotiate with and become really a part of a very unlikely community, unlikely in the sense that it was very unlikely in the beginning, that gives him a kind of satisfaction that is not available to him in the zone, in the strict zones of privacy, within, let us say, this the realm of teenage sex with Suzette. So sex is one way, sex and music are one way of achieving liberation, achieving a new beginning. At the same time, sex and liberation have stings in their tails, and one of the ways of avoiding that particular sting, or avoiding that particular degeneration of those realms into the realm of corruption and artificiality, is to form communal bonds, which is only done through conflict. Okay? In this case, the conflict takes the place of takes the form of race riots. And one of the most notable ways, or one of the most notable communities that is that the novel finally produces, as remember the ending of the novel, the starting of the novel starts with this slightly cynical meditation of absolute beginner, look what has happened to us, they're buying us every year. The ending of the novel ends on that note of hope and welcome. So the race riots are over. The narrator has realized the only way that he can maintain his note of liberatory individualism is to bind, is to combine with other kinds of people into this radical community. And he's in the airport, remember? He's going, and the plane has landed with all these new arrivals coming in. In a sense, they are absolute beginners in London. They're about to start their life. If this happened in the beginning of the novel, we can imagine the narrator going, oh yeah, whatever, they've just arrived, they'll be, the London will suck them up. After a while, there'll be suits and taxpayers, they're all adults, boring people, don't want to have to do anything to do with them, and walk away. And by the end of the novel, though, look at his welcome. Welcome to London, greetings from England, and the end of the quotation is, you've met your first teenager. That is what it is, a scene of reconciliation between an erstwhile disgruntled monadic teenager who thought self-sufficiency equates trying to distance yourself from everyone else and tightly knitting yourself into a subculture, in this case of jazz, and teenage sex. At the end of the journey, this is how he greets complete adult. Remember, adult used to be a dirty word in the beginning of the novel. By the end, he's greeting them with this word of really quite moving and poignant welcome, because the people who are arriving look at him slightly strangely, right? Why is this boy trying, you know, what is he saying? It's not immediately obvious that they have fallen into a kind of communal embrace with each other. Nonetheless, he plucks up the courage and is moved to welcome complete strangers into what he claims to be his own city, precisely because of the experiences of communal bonding he's been through during the race riots with a very unlikely band of people who stand up to the rioters. Remember, the first thing he notices about during the riots is this old woman and this old man, grocers, who pull this West Indian student in as he's been chased by a mob, right? So it's not, in other words, liberatory action is not age specific. It's not funky teenagers doing the deed. The first call of arms against this vicious riot is sounded by really quite old and conventionally, in his eyes, conventionally produced as washed out people. And then he starts twigging. He starts thinking, hang on, this really disgusts me. This race riot it upsets my whole notion of London. Who are the people banding together to challenge this decay? Who are the people banding together to really release possibilities of standing up to, of liberating ourselves, of becoming who we are? These two old people, this old couple. So the banding that he finds himself in changes from the jazz clubs that he frequents, et cetera, to a whole wider spectrum of society, which enables him to say right at the end, welcome to London, greetings from England. A tentative beginning, perhaps, of his own realization into an adulthood that is communal and enabling and not too individualistic and disabling, but a beginning nonetheless, and that is where the novel ends. So if you look at structurally, the notion of beginning at the beginning of the novel had connotations of ending to it, right? It is already stop-ended, they buy us out, there's nothing sacred anymore, a 14-year-old has become a star, etc. The notion of beginning is stop-ended in the beginning of the novel. By the end of the novel, the notion of beginning is given a possibility of opening up. In other words, the structural end of the novel is the true beginning, is one of the true beginnings that we are offered as a possibility. Now keep those things in mind for the rest of the unit. What we have looked at today is the notion of freshness, beginning, modernity, whatever you wish to call it, having a contradictory pull, right? One pole of it is negative, artificially produced, conformist, etc. The other pole of it is positive. It has genuine possibilities of individual liberation, but a liberation that's not individualist. It's a liberation that provides space to individuals only if they learn the necessary art of negotiation, mediation, and interaction with other people around them. Okay? Now think of that idea and how it's linked to concepts of history, of space, of city, of community, of society. And the role that a literary artifact such as a novel has in this particular meditation. Because over the next three sessions, one of the things, or some of the things we'll do, is to look at this relation between cultural artifacts, such as the novel, such as music, such as painting, etc., and how they participate in and how they mediate in into this idea of communal beginnings and endings, into an idea of the historical reality that surrounds every individual, and into the idea of how an individual sees her or himself in relation to the people around them. So in short, the relationship between culture and society, the relationship between culture and spaces, think of the city spaces in this novel, and we'll come back to this idea of the cities and spaces subsequently. The relationship between culture and historical moments, and the relationship between cultural forms themselves. Here, the relationship between novels and music, for example, is particularly highlighted. We'll look at other cases of various cultural forms interacting with each other. How they release within us this conflicted but necessary idea of fresh starts, of modernity, of contemporary reality, and of beginnings. That is something we'll look at in the next three, over the next 3 weeks. Good. Any questions? Are you ready to fall asleep again? Okay. Sorry? Okay. Right. Next week's reading is up on the web again. Do please read the extracts. Raymond Williams is your first extract. And the secondary, the backup, the secondary extract is Stephen Greenblatt. read those two pieces before coming to the lecture, and we'll talk about some other cultural forms and community and history and blah, blah, everything else. Okay. Have a good day.